House Finance coming to order at 1:34 p.m. February 21st, 2012. Members present, Representative Guttenberg, Representative T. Wilson, Vice Chair Fairclough, Stoltz, Co-Chair Thomas, Representative Dugan, Representative Edgerton, Representative Costello, and Representative Newman. We have a quorum. We have before us today a presentation from Mr. Byrd from the National Conference of State Legislators, and we will also the operating budget, which we've obviously been discussing in the broad aspect, that we will actually bring the CS up. I think that was probably in our enthusiasm and zeal to move forward. We forgot to do that. So
just the bill.
Just the bill. Well, just for to notice it officially, and my co-chair will take over.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, we're just going to, we noticed that HB 284, so we're bringing it up, setting it aside since we, our speaker that we have here for today will be talking about the operating budget, the impacts federal cuts may have on us, whether it's this year or next year. And so, you know, we saw Michael Byrd in Florida when we were down there hearing the bad news from all the states, and now bad things were down there, and you know we're living in a life of luxury compared to many of the states down below. And that was the National Congress of State Legislators. So at this time, we'll bring Michael Byrd up to make the presentation on the Federal Budget Control Act and its possible economic impacts on Alaska. This is huge. It could be megabucks, and so hopefully everybody's watching on TV, because I think that the impact, again, gets back to our prudence, I guess, and fiscal restraint.
Sure. I would just only add to the discussion, we are in a short-term false sense of security in our lap of luxury. We're 90% excess dependence on a declining resource with ever-expanding expansion of new entitlements. So I think we're in worse than shape than a lot of other states, but we just have a short-term sense of security.
And that was a key thing, sitting there in the audience for 2 days, knowing that we're wallowing in supposedly surpluses. When you look at it, we really aren't. We look at the obligations we have compared to the other states who have billions of debt. And then, you know, don't hate us because we have money. We told them, when you guys were doing well, we were doing bad. And so, and there were several of us down there trying to hide.
It must have been difficult for you.
Well, for me not to say a word for a day and a half, yes. And then they finally said, you know, Representative Thomas from Alaska, and I said, don't hate me. Yeah, so, don't hate. Yes, it was very hard, Mr. Dugan, for me to restrain from sitting and doing the dance. So this time, Michael, welcome to Alaska. You got to see the mountains this morning. We took him to Zen's. He had Chinese food last night, and by the time we let him go to bed, it was, I think, 2 o'clock your time and maybe 1 or 2 in Washington time. So welcome to Alaska, and we'll turn it over to you. And look around once in a while, because we will have questions, and I'll address the members who have questions for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, members of the committee, members of the public. My name is Michael Byrd. I'm the Senior Federal Affairs Counsel for the National Conference of State Legislatures. I've been invited here to speak about the federal budget, its potential and deficit reduction, its potential effect, whether it be short-term or long-term, on the state of Alaska in particular. Obviously, I don't come here in terms of any kind of a policy preference for one way or the other, but to try to share with you information and my insights into what's going on in Washington, D.C., so that you will be able to plan for what appears to be something that is very imminent, and that is, you know, significant reductions in assistance to state and local governments, and ultimately the restoration of fiscal sanity in the nation's capital after many, many years, if not decades, of some insanity. That's my own personal conclusion. It's also nice to, I haven't been invited to North Dakota yet. That's,
as you know.
And you probably know why, in terms of their own fiscal condition. There are many states, many state legislative leaders that write to them occasionally pleading for them to share in some of their surplus. I'm sure you may be getting some of those calls also.
Even in the last week or so, we've gone up $10 plus a barrel. So it's not like we're going to be hurting, but our people will be, because either way, it's a double-edged sword for us.
I fully understand. Having worked in a couple of legislatures where energy is an extremely important issue, and both in terms of its production or its refinement or its distribution. I'm going to break this presentation down into four parts. I'm going to try to not use lingo that the federal government uses, so that if I start to use it, if I use a term you're not familiar with, please raise your hand. Don't harm me if you possibly can. I don't intend to do it, because they do use a lot of terminology that those of you in state capitals just don't use in terms of your own fiscal policy making. The first thing here, this is sort of just a picture of where everything is. We could change this picture almost weekly. I've used this one here in terms of the total budget surplus and the deficit. What you really have to do is kind of follow the red line and the blue line, and I have to take you back a few months, unfortunately, because last week we spent all of our time in the Washington, D.C. office analyzing the president's budget, and then preparing a summary of the payroll tax and the unemployment insurance benefit extension thing, and both of which are up on our webpage. So I didn't get a chance to update this chart to reflect the president's latest budget, because that's the blue line in there. But as you can obviously see, the deficit in terms of its projections is extremely deep. And that one straight line that's going over to the right-hand corner is really where current law would take you, as opposed to the proposals that have been put on the table either by the president or the negotiations that took place during the course of last year. The federal government is definitely remains in deficit mode. It will probably conclude FY12 somewhere about 1.2 to 1.3 trillion. I've been a legislative staff person for a long time, and I started out in this business using thousands and millions, and it's been a long time in terms of my D.C. career that I even get to use billions, because everything is the numbers are just absolutely staggering. So this chart will show you, the problem is persistent. It isn't going away. There's obviously no resolution of it at this point in time. Now, on this chart here, and once again, the numbers here have also changed a little bit with the presentation of the president's budget last week, only to the extent that the deficits from fiscal year 13 over to 16 go from 900, not that number that's there, down to 612, based upon his recommendations. But the number you have to keep your eye on is the one on the bottom, the percent of gross domestic product that is, in turn that the debt subject is the debt is limit the debt limit is subject to. You can see those numbers are going up. That was what the big fight was about all during last summer, and that is that 15.9, that 16.6 in terms of what the debt limit is. Nothing is bringing that up. It is on a track over the course of the next decade or so to go into the mid-20s if nothing is done. That is a huge number, and a number that a lot of some make some fun of in terms of, really we're on a course to be like some of the countries in Europe who are really in some very desperate economic situations right now. So this is nothing to make light of, and I'm not saying the federal policymakers are making light of it. They just haven't been able to reach consensus on what to do about it. The next one here, this is my favorite.
Representative Newman.
I'm sorry, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Byrd. Again, just because you pointed it out, and it's something I've been trying to follow too, is the percent of the debt. How do we relate those numbers to the other numbers in this chart? When we're looking at this chart here, the one prior to this.
Well,
relative to each other?
Right. The key thing, we do receipts and spending in terms of where the federal government is. Right now, for every dollar that is spent, 60 cents is brought in. The other 40 cents is borrowed. That's the bottom line. I mean, you can all relate to that. And that has been in that area for a couple of years. So in order to make spending work, you have to increase the debt limit because you have to borrow it. If you don't borrow it, then you default. Once again, I take you back to last August, and that was what the big fight in Washington, D.C. was about. Are we going to take a chance and see if there's a default and what the markets will do, or are we not? I'm going to come back to that a little bit later. So, I mean, these numbers are just, I mean, the numbers are staggering, and they're very high. But, I mean, the key thing is if you start up at the top, you're just not taking enough money to pay for what you have committed yourself to pay for. And that's primarily driven by most of the mandatory and the entitlement programs and the fact that the federal tax code is in bad need of revision. Is that good enough?
I think that's exactly what our co-chair is trying to keep us from doing.
Okay.
Thank you.
This one here is my favorite chart because now I am using, there is some lingo up here that is definitely very federal, but current law, which is the green line, in terms of where spending is going into the future, current law would take you here in terms of what spending is going to be as a percent and the debt as a percent of the gross domestic product. But reality is the line that swings upward. Reality reflects, one, the Bush, what are known as the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003, and they're being sunset or not, the alternative minimum tax, the payment for military overseas military operations that's not offset in any way, provider reimbursements for Medicare physicians. That's reality. That is what Congress and the administration, whether it's the current one or previous ones, have not been able to resolve, is how to fix both their tax policy and spending policy in those two areas, and at the same time how to work on the health-driven entitlements, primarily Medicare, but to a lesser degree, but also importantly Medicaid at the federal level. So spending, I mean, the obligation to spend continues in a very, very, very high arc if nothing is done. And it gets a little bit more real on this page. So far, the federal policymakers, in terms of deficit reduction, what they've been able to discuss and to decide upon, they have nestled and found a comfort zone down there in the blue square in the discretionary spending area. This is the only place they've been able to go with some sort of consensus over the course of the last 4 years. They've pretty much, whenever someone brings up Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, and that's changed a little bit, obviously interest on the debt. When you get down to other spending and discretionary, and those are the 13% is a part of the 20, and the other spending is really just other mandatory programs like the temporary assistance for the needy families block grant or the food stamps program and things of that nature. The softest part of the budget, the one that they can reach some consensus on, is in that blue square. And, you know, they don't end up in political tugs of war. They don't end up in big policy differences, even though, you know, there are certainly disagreements over whether even they should make any changes here. And, of course, this is all federal spending. The only thing that doesn't appear on here is spending that is essentially generated through the tax code, through their various deductions and credits, and that, we'll talk about that a little bit later on. And just to take that blue square and to break it down a little bit, and I
Representative Dugan, please.
Representative?
Yeah, when we get done with one page, maybe we can wait.
Okay.
Looking in the page before this, where it shows net interest at 14%.
Yep.
If the deficit continues to climb, and we have to borrow more money, then I assume that net interest as a percentage of
federal spending will increase. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes and no. It will, you know, that number is actually suppressed by the fact that, you know, the federal government borrows from itself to some extent, and of course with a very, very low, very, very low interest rates that it charges itself. But net, that number will, yes, it will definitely go up. It all is dependent on what happens inside those other squares. But if we make the assumption that nothing happens inside those other squares, and somehow our the fiscal policy and monetary policy at the federal level changes, and all of a sudden you have, you know, a Federal Reserve that decides, you know, maybe we need to turn the low interest rates off and let them jack them up a little bit, that would change that number. So that number is sort of artificially low at this point in time.
Right. If I might, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to understand this. So any increase in any of those other squares is necessarily going to have, unless there's a big change in the way we do business, there's going to be a corresponding reduction in that last blue square, or there's going to have to be.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fairclough.
Just to put a finer point on that, 50% of all American spending is on Social Security and health care.
Mm-hmm.
Another way to say what we're seeing?
Pardon?
50% of all spending in America, based on what we're looking at here, is on Social Security and health care.
That is correct, Representative.
That's false. Thank you, Mr. Byrd. You have it listed as net interest. You said that's artificially suppressed. If you called it debt service, would it still be the same percentage?
Yeah, just about.
Just a semantics. Yes. So not because you're calling it interest, it's a lower amount. It's,
yes.
It could just as easily be called debt service.
Yes.
Okay.
I tried to be loyal here to what a lot of my colleagues do use in other organizations, and loyal to the Congressional Budget Office and to the Office of Management and Budget in terms of what terms they use,
make sure I wasn't getting lost in some.
And that's not necessarily loyalty in capital letters. It's just that's a professional thing.
Thank you.
All right, then we'll take the blue square, and what we'll do is break the blue square down, and I use this chart primarily because for next year, for FY13, the year, the budget that you're writing, everything in here is going to be subject to being reduced except for the 15% in the transportation part of the pie. And to some extent, some of the stuff under veterans benefits, but for the most part, that's all going to be subject to across-the-board cuts, and like I said, that's Chapter 3 in the presentation. But I also use this chart to advise you and to inform you that you cannot balance the federal budget by taking out one of these segments. It just doesn't work. The numbers just don't add up whatsoever. Every now and then we hear, well, if you just got rid of all that justice money at the federal level, the Byrne grants and whatnot, that it would balance, the budget would balance overnight. It is not going to happen. But it also gives you a sense of where the money is distributed by appropriators at the federal level. This is what they appropriate. They actually have control over this, unlike the mandatory programs, which are really governed by formulas, by population, by economic factors, by income factors, and a number of other ingredients.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we're looking at this slide, are health care costs embedded in those different divisions also? There's pieces of it I saw in the previous slide, but in defense there was still TRICARE? TRICARE was still included in the defense number, so there's more health care costs that are embedded throughout this.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, this health number here is what I like to think of as the non-Medicaid world. The preventive health, the health block grants, the drug abuse and mental health block grant, and a number of other programs, sort of like that. It's sort of like, I like to think of it as a non-Medicaid world. It's just easier to understand. Hopefully it is for you, too. That's sort of concludes part one. And this is going to be very brief. Brief history of deficit reduction studies, reports, and negotiations. I think I, with some degree of pride, inform you that over the course of the last year, I had the professional honor to read approximately 2,300 pages of various deficit reduction reports, recommendations, commission studies, negotiations between the President and the Vice President, the members of Congress, and this brief history. And all of those, and these are some of the more prominent ones, I do want to say that when I get down to several others here, the one at the top, the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, was the President's Study Commission that was chaired by former U.S. Senator Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, the former Chief of Staff of President Clinton, and the Bipartisan Policy Center. Every one of these commissions came to a variety of conclusions. The several others include the negotiations that the President undertook with the Speaker of the House, the Vice President undertook with the various leaders and the members of Congress. It also included what is called the Gang of Six, now the Gang of 42 plus in the Senate, that has agreed to some sort of a comprehensive deficit negotiation, and that includes your two U.S. senators. The Gang of 100 in the House, once again, another bipartisan group that have come to the same conclusions. And when I say the same conclusions, this is what they come to, that in order to get the federal deficit and the national debt under control, there's got to be both spending and revenue recommendation. Everything must be on the table, not that it would necessarily stay there. Everything they've done has been bipartisan. Mostly, folks on these commissions and in groups are federal policymakers. Only the Bipartisan Policy Center involves state and local officials, which I think is to their credit, because the missing ingredient in almost all 2,300 pages that I wrote is no discussion, no chart, no table, no analysis of what is the effect going to be on our partners at the state and local level. There's one page in the Bipartisan Policy Center report that goes into, you know what, we ought to be thinking about what is going to happen if somehow we decide that we are not going to be involved. We're not engaged, funding at lower levels, changing the task force, and whatnot. It's frightening, and I think it represents the challenge for all of you, for NCSL as an organization, in terms of what happens when they finally do get serious about a deficit reduction plan. I should stay there. The next one.
Of course, Representative Costello.
Through the chair, Mr. Byrd, so are you aware of states' efforts to identify the impact that they will have? I know here we have a fiscal policy subcommittee of this group, but what is your awareness in terms of what the other states are doing to prepare?
I think it depends where they sit fiscally to some extent. I watched last year as approximately 8 states enacted what I call just-in-case funds, not rainy day funds, not stabilization funds, the funds that are essentially where they put aside a chunk of money just in case the federal government decided that it was going to reduce its appropriations to state-federal programs. Numerous states are doing what you're doing in this room today, and that is trying to get a sense as to where this is all going in Washington, D.C., talking obviously with their congressional delegations, inviting groups like us, and working with the executive branch in some cases in terms of trying to plot a strategy, and also to just do an analysis. Typically, and this has been my experience, and please tell me otherwise if it isn't yours, federal funds are usually a subdued discussion. You're always trying to balance your general fund budget. You're trying to deal with any other special trust funds, whether it's a Medicaid fund or a transportation fund or a pension fund or whatnot. And federal funds sort of just comes in under the radar. It's something that you know is there. But I have to tell you that I'm spending a lot of time today and talking to other states, especially where the proportion of federal funds is high compared to the total number of funds that you actually commit yourself to in terms of your budget. This is doesn't get higher than the state of Alaska. You're number one. So you're number one in my heart. You're number one also on the charts in terms of the percentage of federal funds.
Does that make us the number one target also with other legislators?
We're going to come to that. I think it means that any big decisions that are made at the federal level could easily impact you far more hard than they will in some other states where there's less defense presence, less grant activity, less procurement activity. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit because I'm coming to that.
I'm just going to make a quick comment in regards to a comment that Mayor Kohler made the other day in my office, that the power that the state of Alaska, through all our power companies, Combination, Anchorage, Fairbanks, everywhere in Alaska, is less than the Seattle Light produces daily. The whole state of Alaska, that was totally amazing, that all the little co-ops we have running around here, we don't produce as much power as the city of Seattle does, so Seattle Light up there. That's how small we are. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in our budgets, when we see federal receipt, not actually federal funds, is that something that it's better to not have in our budget since we don't know whether or not receipts are being done versus federal funding dollars?
I can only answer that as a former fiscal analyst and also someone who doesn't. I mean, why would you not want to show that? Why would you not want to be aware of it?
Follow up. I think, you know, it's one thing to be, because if we just kind of give them the chance to go looking for the money, then versus actual money here, they would have to go through maybe another process to accept federal money.
No, the federal government has got very talented people who are tracking all expenditures that are made in a variety of categories to all states, to all communities, to various counties and regions, even to individuals. I mean, all that is tracked. And it's included in the report that's called the Consolidated Federal Funds Report or the Federal Aid to States Report. Both come out of the Department of Commerce. The good news is those are really good comprehensive reports. The bad news is they're no longer in the budget. They are going to terminate them, which means, and I only say that in some pity for your help, we are working with the Governors Association to find a way to recreate this mechanism. It's the best source out there, and it gives you a real good sense, as not only on a comparative basis, but on an in-state basis, what kind of federal money, whether it be a defense contract, whether it be a unemployment insurance benefit payment, or whether it be a grant program, whether it be a procurement activity of some kind, it's all there. In very, very harsh nighttime reading, if you are ever having a hard time getting to sleep, you'll want to pick up the Consolidated Federal Funds Report and come through it. It's a great source. I say that only as a legislative geek. I mean, it's great information.
I was like going over to watch Gavel to Gavel at 8 o'clock. Just about as much fun.
Did I answer your question? The areas, and I mean, when you read all these reports, the same subjects come up over and over and over again. And this is why I said it in Florida when Representative Thomas was attending an NCSL meeting. I've said it in many others. And that is, if you take all 535 members of Congress, with some exceptions, and you ask them, and you were to pose them the question, what do we need to do in order to bring some sensibility to federal fiscal policy making? This is what their answer would be. We've got to address every single one of these items in here. There may not be agreement on medical malpractice because I think there are certain members who think that's really a state issue. And transportation is often coupled with energy in some of these reports. It just doesn't make it as often as transportation does. The thing is that once those individuals leave those glass enclosed rooms and go to their party caucuses, things change dramatically in terms of what, you know, because everybody is saying pretty much the same thing. I've
I've had the good fortune to be able to sit with, at least with staff people and the various members of both the House and Senate. And when they talk about what needs to be done, this is what they say. But when you get into the sound bites, you get into the press conferences, and now, of course, into political campaigns, it changes a little bit. I'm sure none of you have seen any evidence of that anywhere. any questions on this? Because now I'm proceeding to the meat.
Yeah, you like meat.
And I did want to say at this point in time that I do want to thank the staff of this committee. They've been, Pete and all the other folks, they've been great in helping me put all this together. It's a good thing that we're in the electronic age, because otherwise there would be erase marks, scratches. There would be some of these slides would not be happening. Okay, so what happened? Why should you care? And this is where I'm going to use two terms now that you're going to hear from your, if you haven't already heard from your congressional delegation, you'll hear from many, many others, and that is the Budget Control Act. The Budget Control Act is a legislation that was passed in August of 2011. It sets the table for deficit reduction in both discretionary spending and defense spending for the next either 9 or 10 years. We're going to clarify that. So Budget Control Act, I'll call it the BCA from here on in. And as you can see here, that there were three components to the BCA. One was to establish some caps on discretionary spending. They were able to accomplish that. They then set up a 12-member special committee that had all those reports I talked about and all the negotiations to use as their references to come up with a plan, and that failed. And that means another word that you don't use, and that would be sequestration, but members of Congress and members of the administration use. I mean, it's in its easiest terminology, it's essentially mandatory across the board reductions. Except for the BCA, it's mandatory across the board reductions for certain programs, not for all programs. And I'll help clarify that, because I think this is where you're heading in terms of over the course of the next year and then into the next decade. This is going to be in play. Now, the BCA, I think it's very important for you to know, because this is where the numbers match up at the federal level. I mean, this was all about making a deal in order to increase the debt ceiling by $2.1 trillion. They were about to hit the debt ceiling. The federal government had received a credit downgrade, and I should footnote to that. Because they received a credit downgrade, five states got credit downgrades at the same time, and including two probably of the most fiscally sound states in the country, both Utah and Virginia. And in exchange for the debt ceiling being increased, which is now in effect, the debt ceiling can now go up to $16.4 trillion, where I am using the T word again, in exchange for two pockets of reductions. And I have to admit, I was having a light moment. This stuff is gooey junk. I pulled out the cat in the hat and said, try to make sense of thing one and thing two. Because thing one, and if Mr. Chairman, I hope I can use that terminology. I know it's not professional, but there's got to be a light moment once in a while during the course of this. This is $917 billion in discretionary spending reductions, less interest, over 10 years. What that means is that discretionary spending is targeted to go up, and there's another chart I should go to right here. This is the same chart. This is hard to read, I know. But as you can see, the total amount of discretionary spending that is permitted under the BCA, this is two pages down, goes up every year. And I've just told you there is $917 billion in reductions. That's because if you follow current law and you didn't impose these artificial spending caps, there'd be another $917 billion in spending authorized over a 10-year period. So it's missing. So what they did is they set an artificial spending ceiling, essentially. All right, that has been accomplished. That will take 10 years. I should say it's been accomplished if the law is not amended or some other negotiation somehow supersedes what is happening. So let's go back to the BCA. So pot one, or thing one, $917 billion, Thing two was to give the super committee an opportunity to find another $1.2 trillion in cuts over a nine-year period. They failed. And because they failed, which is highlighted in the next one, failure, well, we'll go back, we're going to come to it. The 400, there is now sequestration about to happen at the beginning of calendar year 13, or right after the first quarter of federal fiscal year 13. That means there must be, over 9 years, $492 billion in cuts to domestic discretionary spending on top of what's in Pot 1, and another $492 billion in defense spending reductions. Has to be. It's mandatory. There's no choice. That is a lot of money, no doubt about it. This is also, I would say, speaking politically, probably a very soft part of the agreement. There has already been a lot of discussion about, well, maybe we should get rid of the defense part. And, of course, that leads to the discussion about, well, then where are we going to find the other $492 billion? Maybe we need to go up to the other $492 billion and just double it. That would be your money. That would be state federal money. Not that defense money isn't your money and something that you're concerned about. But this is soft to some extent. And when the president introduced his budget last year, and I have a part at the end I'm going to go into, he essentially eliminated both pools in exchange for his own deficit reduction plan. But I want to save that for the end. So, I mean, it's under siege already. And that would be typical of what goes on in the nation's capital. I mean, I think I've been there too long. I've been there 25 years. And for the last decade plus easily, I mean, the way Washington, D.C. has resolved their really big revenue and spending issues is essentially to declare what they call an emergency. And that is, if it's a spending issue, you just don't have to have the money to pay for it. So when they did, for example, a program like Medicare Part D or the military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, not paid for. They borrowed the money. When they did the tax cuts in 2001 and 2003 and then extended them again in 2010, they didn't have the revenue to pay for that in terms of what that loss would mean regarding their own spending trend lines. So that's what they have to fix. And this is the first step. I am going to give them some credit. This is a first step. They finally have done something to start the trend line going slightly downward. Any question here on thing one, thing two? Because there's going to be more thing one than thing two coming. But this is your world now. We're talking about you're getting ready for your 13 budget and then your 14 budget. This is all in place right now. The super committee failed. The process is over. The automatic cuts for 9 years are in place.
But, you know, we've been seeing federal creep already, you know, in different programs.
Mr. Chairman, you've stolen the words from my one of my next charts.
I didn't see these charts.
Brilliant. I've shown you this one before. I know this is sort of like double speak, but when you see the number when spending goes up and really it's going down, that's where I disavow myself of federal terminology. Let's see here. Let's go. Okay, here's now we're in thing two. What we can say about a sequester, because this is your world, this is state federal programs, these are all domestic programs, both mandatory and discretionary, by $586 billion. I know it's a little hard to read on the screen, but eight out of every $10 in that program is exempt from being cut. So they've written a long slew, and some of it is attached to the end of the report that you have. There's about five pages worth of programs that are exempt from this. But what it means is that when they're looking over 10 years, well, at least in the next year, when they're looking next year for their $45 to $50 billion in cuts to domestic discretionary programs,
They will be looking in the red part, in the covered part. That's it. And this is, and on the defense side, everything's pretty much gained. There are some exceptions, but it isn't really worth it for the sake of the circle to even note them.
Do you have a question, Dugan? No, okay.
Okay. Thanks. All right, so we're in the second pot. We're still at the $1.2 trillion in automatic cuts. Here's some of the programs that are exempt. For next year only, we're only talking about FY13. Transportation is exempt, Medicaid, Pell Grants, you know, child nutrition and food stamps, and on. There are many others. This is just a sample. Programs that are not exempt. Now we're talking real business. We're talking your 13 budget. These are the things that aren't exempt. Education, employment and training, energy, environment, all the E programs. Defense at the bottom, national forest money, mineral leasing money, social services, housing, community development, justice. This is where they're going to find, for next year, somewhere between $45 and $50 billion in savings, right here. That adds up to about 8-9% of what you would probably expect in these areas. Until something has changed, this is the current law. Questions there? All right, now we get to play guessing games. And this is what the chairman brought up just a little while ago. If you'll check the changes. Actually, on domestic discretionary spending, they already started the process prior to the agreement they reached last year. So in 2011, they reduced this state federal grant money essentially by 4.6%. And I should give credit here. You'll see in the right-hand column the letters FFIS, that's Federal Funds Information for the States. That's an entity that the NCSL and the Governors Association created. They do all of our tracking. It's their information. We rely upon them to get these numbers. So you've already felt a little bit of a downturn on the discretionary or state federal grant side of 4.6% in 11, another 2.7 in the current fiscal year, and it looks like about 9% for next year. But all I'm telling you there is they're in the softest part of the budget. This is the easiest place for both the administration and the members of Congress to go. So, I mean, if nothing changes in terms of current law, that 9% continues out all the way to fiscal year 21.
We could be fighting about who's getting thrown under the bus up here pretty soon.
Are you getting thrown under the bus?
Representative Stoltz.
Is it the softest place because that's where there's more available money, or it's the politically softest?
That's where there's the least available money.
But politically the softest?
I mean, you're not fighting about the Medicare program, you're not fighting about the Medicaid program or Social Security or defense, although defense is now in the mix, and that's what's changing. And you're not talking about interest on the debt.
So kind of like around here, we argue about the small amounts of money and we kind of wave the big ones by.
Yeah. They've gone where it was easiest to go. I mean, that's... All right, impact of the BCI on Alaska, non-defense, thing two. If you'll see the hypothetical pot, this is in thousands, so you've got about $553 million that could hypothetically be covered by sequestration. Take about 9% of that, and here's your number for FY13. So $48 or so million dollars. I mean, to me, that's a lot of money. $48 million is a lot of money. That's all there is to it. That's just you folks. That's not talking about the rest of the...
And it's not listed, though. You're just talking about overall.
But what they will squeeze here is in that 18% of the pie.
Right.
That's where it's coming from.
And that's the listed projects of education, employment, energy...
Yep, that's where they're going. That's where they're going for that $50 million.
Defense.
So I think you're definitely well advised, for now and certainly next fall. You're probably going to be getting lots of phone calls and communications from individuals and groups and whatnot that are obviously affected are going to be affected by these changes. I mean, it's natural, unless the law changes.
Well, we already have the fear of base closures. We already have the fear of base closures in Alaska.
I'm coming to base closure.
Oh, jeez. Okay. Is that a question, Representative Fricklin? Oh, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with some of the cuts, especially like in education, I'm assuming they're not going to look at regulation and those things that we're required to have as a state with less funding.
Representative, you've asked a very, very good question there. I, in my soundest moment, would probably say, you know what, they're probably going to look at the laws and see how they can possibly give the states a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more administrative relief or whatnot. But that requires serious give and take in an environment. If they do appropriations like they've done over the course of the last 15 years, it'll be so intense there's no chance to do those kinds of things. So these will be sort of essentially just basic reductions in services. So it means like a program like No Child Left Behind, and everyone knows about No Child Left Behind. That's a non-exempt program. It's up on the table. Special education grants, you know, which have been around for decades, are all of a sudden a vulnerable program. It's sort of unheard of, but there they are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are they at all talking about looking at trade agreements to allow us to compete in a global market differently than we are now so that we reduce the borrowing of 40 cents on the dollar by increasing our exports?
I'm not a trade expert, but, I mean, if you look at the dynamic of the current debate between the administration and, I would say, the majority of Republicans over in the House and the Senate, I mean, there's more debate about tax policy and trade activities and location of businesses or non-location of businesses and where workers are or where they're not and where profits are and where they're not than there are about the trade agreements. Now, as you well know, I mean, three new trade agreements were enacted into law, last year. So that discussion has been an ongoing one. It took a long time to get past that impasse. They all have, all those trade agreements have got all kinds of innuendo and all kinds of other things in there that we know. But, yeah, I mean, it's been a part of the conversation. But right now, in terms of the budget world, when you start talking trade, you're talking tax policy, and you're talking about business location or dislocation more so than you are about trade, from what I hear.
I just would throw out for the policy committee, as we look at cuts or taxing Americans, if we actually had balanced trade, a lot of our 9% decline would go away immediately because we would start competing in a capitalistic market and be able to dig ourselves out. But as we restrict trade opportunities for individual states and our nations, we're put in a box where we have to work with inside the mousetrap that we've built instead of creating other opportunities globally, which many countries are doing.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I take it that this 9% is an average rather than a prediction. So,
yeah, it's sort of a consensus number. I mean, those people who do this kind of estimating have put the range somewhere between 7.8% and 9.3%. And I've chosen the 9 because I think the 9 only looks a little bit more real. Yeah, maybe it makes the problem look a little bit more severe, but I'd rather that you'd be thinking in terms of perhaps a bigger cut than a softer one. It may end up being a smaller percentage, and there'll be other things that will happen during the course of this calendar year at the federal level that could change the mix on these. So, but I think you're advised to right now 9%, but 9% out into for the next 9 fiscal years each time.
Mr. Chairman,
Paul, okay.
The distinction I was trying to draw, which may not be a proper distinction to draw in this case, is that 9% is a target. That is to say, if, you know, the somehow the number came out that it was going to be 15% for us and less for somebody else, is that possible? Or
I'm going to say yes and no. The 9% is a hard number because it sort of represents approximately somewhere around $45 to $48 billion in national and nationwide state grant cuts to domestic discretionary programs, and a similar number, a little higher over on the defense side. However, for states that are less dependent on federal grant money, and this would be one of them, but highly dependent on defense procurement activity and whatnot, base operations and all those things, then the percentage is not going to be clean. I use this as an illustration more than anything else. It's not going to be clean. And, you know, up until last fall, neither us nor the governors nor FFISs or as associations, we never really tracked defense spending whatsoever. I mean, it's just that we spent all of our time on domestic discretionary. That's where the interest tended to be, and on the mandatory and entitlement programs. But we did a survey of the legislative leadership around the country in December, and that issue came out in the top five. I mean, and it was like, oh, so that was sort of like a call to the table, saying we better start doing it. And you'll be seeing a lot more from our organization in regards to this, as well as from the federal funds information for the states, because we know how important. I think we knew it before, but it was not a compulsory thing to track.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. All right, back to thing two. This is just another example of programs that are going to be subject to sequestration. I only mention these, once again, just as examples. You may be hearing from your own members, from the members of the various communities, from other advocacy groups, that these things that remain on the sequestration table.
They already cut LIHEAP. They already cut LIHEAP last year here, at least in Alaska.
You say we ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah.
Well, it was cut at the federal level as well.
Oh, keep cutting.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I mean, in the old days, is in the 1990s when, you know, the economy was raging. I mean, I think the federal government was very, very, very inclined to look to state and local governments to backfill on programs that couldn't fund very high. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, states and localities responded to that way of thinking. They still think that way, but the numbers have changed. So they still think that way to some extent. But the reality just would not tell you. I mean, you haven't gone through them, but there are states like Nevada and Rhode Island, for example, where their general fund budget is a third or 33% or more lower than it was 4 years ago. That's a lot of cutting, a lot of serious cutting. And that doesn't make the headlines. I know everybody a lot of people like to write about California and what's going on there, but boy, there are a lot of other states where they have had to make some very, very serious reductions. Now, this is sort of the world. This is sort of just a summary. These are the other things, sort of a summary of what's going on. There are so many other issues that relate to fiscal policy that we as an organization follow that do affect you. But in a year like this, where nothing's going to get really resolved until after the November elections, we will continue to follow these issues for you. I mean, to me, that the number four one, the uncertainty, is just looms. Hopefully, I'll be asked to come back to see if anything's uncertainty has blossomed into certainty. I don't know. You may want to kill the messenger if it does. These are the things that are certain for federal fiscal year 2013. Definitely going to be further discretionary spending reductions. These are the areas that will carry the brunt of the reductions. Defense reductions are imminent if the sequester holds. This is a fur, I mean. And then numerous programs are exempt from 13. After that, everything is up for grabs. There is no such thing as a 50-50 defense, 50 defense, 50 non-defense. It's all in one pot, and the appropriators will decide, unless they change the law. A looming crash of 12. My best way to take this is you take the bullets up in January, the December debt ceiling one, which is at the end of the year. The president's budget is out. They fixed the payroll tax for until December, and the UI, the Medicare issue. Everything else here, you can put under November. Between November the 6th and December the 31st, the Congress and the administration, and with you at their side, urging them to go one way or the other, will deal with the question of do we or do we not extend the tax cuts from 2001, 2003, and 2010. They will decide what should be the appropriations for fiscal year 13 because they will have missed their deadline for the 16th consecutive year. The budget resolution will not have been resolved because the House is going to do one and the Senate's not. That's already public knowledge. A variety of tax extenders, which includes a lot of credits and deductions, all sunset at the end of December, they will be up. The debt ceiling, which was resolved last August, reaches 16.4 sometime right around the time everyone's counting ballots or in the following month. So the debt ceiling will be back, which means also credit downgrade potential will be there. And, of course, since nobody knows how the November elections are going to turn out, nobody knows how any of these issues are really going to resolve. But the thing is, they will have to resolve in a 55-day period. A lame duck Congress, and who knows what the makeup is going to be. But if you would invite me back in that period of time, I would be more than... See, I'm not seeking warm weather trips. I don't think you would invite... But in fact, I go to Maine after this. So
we'll apply for a federal grant.
Yeah. So the crash is coming. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to take a little time, just a little bit, because the president's budget is out there, and two pages down from this one is what will be the House budget resolution, even though it's not written yet. But I call these the bookends for where the president is going to be, and at least through the election, and where the House majority is going to be. So these are the highlights of the president's budget. I'm not going to say that I've read all 2,571 pages, but I think that will be good enough of this budget. As you can see, it essentially eliminates sequestration with bullet three, a deficit reduction plan. So it takes out the sequestration we talked about, and essentially ends the tax cuts of 0103 and 10 on high-income individuals. There's Medicare savings of around $370 billion. Medicaid, which is then in the fourth bullet, which is something you should pay very, very close attention to, is in there. Winding down the overseas military operations, you should be able to count that, but it's in there. Higher earner itemized deductions, much like the tax issue. Termination of oil and gas tax preferences, I'm sure you have no interest in that. But, then, you know, those are all on here. I was being facetious. On the Medicaid savings, I've been saying this now for about a year. For the first time in my career, the Medicaid program is low-hanging fruit. It's out there. The federal government is going to extract savings for themselves. The question is, will they extract any savings for you? I would urge you to talk to the two U.S. senators and the member of the House about that topic. If you look at any of the reports that are out there, any of the negotiations that have taken place, Medicaid is right. In fact, it is so right that number three on the president's list here, the reducing the state disproportionate share allotments, that's already been taken. It was taken when they did the payroll tax and the unemployment insurance benefit extension last week. So they've already removed it from this list. That doesn't mean they couldn't cut further on it, but it's I mean, I think, and then there's the jobs initiative. As you can see, because he eliminates sequestration, domestic discretionary spending and defense discretionary spending both go up.
Well, you can draw your own conclusions, what that means. There's some more highlights, consolidations. I put all this out here because I think you'll be hearing more and more and more about that. I know a lot of budgets are declared dead on arrival. I really do believe this is sort of one of the, this will be a part of the debate for the rest of the year. It'll be one of the bookends. The other bookend will be the House Budget Resolution. And Congressman Ryan from Wisconsin, who did a resolution last year, it passed the House, never got through the Senate, and having talked with the staff at length, this is what's likely to be in there. They haven't made any decisions. This is sort of guesswork. But as you can see, it's very, very different. You know, when they go to the discretionary cap over in the House, they'll go below the cap. They did it last year. I mean, they're trying to go there.
Members can't hear what the members over here talking in the audience. We have members here can't hear the speaker. So if you can tone it down or take it outside, appreciate it. Thank you.
There'll be Medicare, Medicaid, and entitlement overhauls. Block grants for Medicaid and food stamps or something that looks like it. A lot of talk about corporate tax reform and simplified tax code. Everybody. There's a lot of pressure over in the House of Representatives to either tone down or eliminate the defense portion of sequestration. Pay freezes and pension contributions. Already the increased pension contributions have already, this year, has already been tapped in part in order to do the payroll tax extension and the unemployment insurance benefit.
Maybe it's our turn to freeze federal hire from employees, even the feds coming to work for us after this. Just to comment, because all our employees went to the feds. Maybe they'll be coming back.
So those are really the two bookends. This is no different than the debate that took place during fiscal year 12 or calendar year 11. And now, federal government expenditures per capita by state, and these are the five things that are where federal expenditures are made: retirement, disability payments, other direct payments like uninsurance, and veterans payments and whatnot, grants, procurement, salaries and wages. Alaska averages on a per capita basis in federal fiscal year 10 about $18,000 per capita, almost double the U.S. average, and Nevada's at the bottom. And I can say that's a little bit, this is something to be concerned about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any insight for us on the 18,000 number? I mean, do we know where it's coming in at? We know that a third of Alaska's budget, when we look at overall economy, is based on military expenses. So when we look at that 18,000, are we looking at that, or are there other things that we can tease out?
Okay. Representative, excellent question. And this, I think, points out a little bit more. In terms of per capita spending on salary and wages and procurement and grants, a lot of money flowing into the state from those three particular sources. And the reason I highlight those three, where you rank so high, those are the things that are inside of sequestration for the most part. So, I mean, if they are really going to hold, to those kinds of defense cuts, up here, I mean, retirement and disability, I mean, part of this is also driven just by your population. I mean, that's a lot of that's driven by your population. I mean, this doesn't mean that you're getting, that Alaska gets the second most amount of money for salary and wages on a per capita basis. But, you know, take a state like New Hampshire. I'm going to be visiting them. They rank in the 30s and the 40s on almost everything because they are not inclined to take a lot of federal grant money. They have very few military or procurement operations in their state. They do rank a little high on retirement and disability because it is an older population. And not much on the direct payments because of their income factors.
Representative Wilson and Fairclough.
How proportionate is this to how much of the federal government? I mean, they own our state, you know, over half of it. So, I mean, if they would give us back, you know, our resources, I think we'd come out ahead.
There's probably a question I probably don't want to get in the middle of, right?
I thought I'd try.
I really don't know if I can go there.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at salaries and wages, does that mean that we have more federal employees here managing different businesses in the state of Alaska than other states?
On a per capita, when you're looking at it per capita, yeah, it means that you have significant presence.
Well, because the population and how it's divided is popping us up to the top. So I'm just wondering if we have, if we looked at a ratio of federal employees that are here versus the population of the state, my guess is.
I can get that for you. I don't have that with me.
Thank you.
Yeah. That would be interesting. If you look at U.S. Forest Service, Park Service, all the federal lands that they're trying to manage, and I think that's what Representative Wilson was getting to. If they want to leave it, good for us. You know, we can go out there and enjoy ourselves again instead of worrying about a boundary that's imaginary line there and get drug away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for answering the representative's question.
Well, I knew what she was after.
Representative.
Representative Guttenberg.
Yeah, I mean, the salary and wages is an interesting question. Is it that, or is it that they're paid more here because of, there's a, thank you. Is it that, or is there paid more here because of COLA? There's a high COLA here.
Well, that is part of it also. I mean, there's a lot of factors that enter into that equation. I mean, I put that up there just to give everyone a sense, and we're doing it now for every state, where they sit, not for challenging each other, but for kind of getting an idea of what the mix is. I think the bottom line, the most important thing on here is the bottom. I mean, in terms of the where you're so high, you're so vulnerable to changes in federal spending. Take the lands issue aside, but if there's going to be major adjustments at the federal level, and they, at some point in time, it's going to happen. I mean, they all know this. The question is, when is it going to happen? Maybe this next election takes some of the tarnish off. And allows for more camaraderie and negotiation than we've seen up to this point. I'm an optimist at heart, so hope springs eternal for it to occur.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on the salaries and wages, though, as the state sets salary scales and tries to remain competitive in an environment, the number of federal employees that we have in the state is important to how we respond because as our co-chairman said, we lose great geologists and other state employees to the federal government based on a better pay scale that's been alluded to here. And so then when we come back through and we try to retain that same expertise for the state government, we need to pay that higher wage. So it is affecting the state government, how many employees that we have in Alaska that are federal employees, the wage that they're making, and the departments that they're working in inside of federal government. So there may be something interesting for Alaska in looking at how the federal government has placed people in our state and where they're earning wages at and what that might look like in a downturn.
Yeah, I'm taking notes on this because I want to be able to respond to you, Representative, in a little bit more detail. And if there's anybody in the room who could catch me afterwards who has probably done a lot more work on this than I have, I'm prepared to sit down with them and talk the night away on that. But I still think I think you need to impress these things upon your congressional delegation because of that. And when I go up to New England at the end of the week, I will be saying some of the same things to a couple of New England states that happen to rank, you know, look a lot like you in terms of some of these numbers, especially in Connecticut, looks a lot like this.
Representative Newman, then Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Byrd, I'm interested in your perspective because you get the opportunity to look at a lot of budgets, particularly at the federal level now, and I appreciate the little more information, although we pretty much knew we have less federal money coming in and we'll continue to have less federal money coming in. But the state of Alaska is in a kind of unique situation where we've got a little bit of money now, but the Trans-Alaska Pipeline continues to decline at 6 or 7% a year. It has been for 20-plus years. Our cost of government continues to rise. We've got three companies that paid 90% of the corporate taxes in the state, you know, and again, 90% of our revenue comes out of our out of that pipeline. Our opportunities for the state of Alaska, we're not very diversified in our economy. Looking at that lack of diversification, along with less federal money coming in, what recommendations would you give to try? I know that's a pretty high-level situation, but you look, and I ask that as your perspective as somebody with NCSL who looks at a lot of budgetary items like this. That's a big question, I know, Mr. Chair. Yes, but that's the issue we're trying to face right now, and that's why the chair brought you here. I mean, to help.
Maybe above my pay grade, but I do recall when I was hired by the Oklahoma legislature 30 years ago. It was 30 years ago. And they were
in their thousands.
That's they were at their at the height of their oil boom. And I mean there was money was flowing freely and there was you couldn't say no to anybody because and the sky was the limit because the price of oil was so high and there were derricks right there in front of the Capitol that were functioning. I was there for all 6 months when it took the plunge. And so like any energy-dependent state, it went from, you know, it was not ready. It hadn't taken any action whatsoever to plan for what, and I'm sure you've gone through this before. This wouldn't be the first time that something would have happened on your production side or with the price of, you know, of oil and gas and whatnot if it were to decline. So you've had practice at doing that. But, I mean, I think you've also attempted that, whether I'm not going to say it was right or wrong. I mean, much like New Hampshire, you don't have an income tax, you don't have a sales tax. You've made a decision where you're going to find your revenue for the bulk of your activities. Much unlike, you don't look like most of the other states in that regard. I put in New Hampshire because they, too, you know, have avoided income tax and sales tax. But do have property taxes and other excise taxes and whatnot. So, I mean, for me, it's always about, as a fiscal analyst, it's always about planning. And the question is, I mean, it's very, very hard to, when you're riding a high crest, to look down the road and think things might be bad. I hope that we're able to continue to show you certain information about where the track, at least on the federal side, and if you, I know your staff definitely looks at things like, okay, what are the other states doing? That's why we, like when the chairman mentioned going down to Florida for our meeting, that's an opportunity to sort of exchange ideas, information, why, where you're going. I'm not trying to get out of the question here. I'm not sure if I've got a good recommendation because the thing is that you're all in the same business. You're all trying to make, despite your diversity and despite maybe a different kind of revenue base and spending a plan and more or greater or less dependence on federal funds, there's a lot to be learned from one another. And we've gotten very good, I think, about technologically knowing that travel is far more restricted than it has been in a long, long time and doing more things electronically where you can exchange ideas and whatnot. I don't know if I'm not doing a good job, I don't think, of answering your question because I don't know what the real recommendations are other than to at this point in time, with the information you have, you know, start working towards where do we want to be at the end of the year, presuming they can't reach agreement and the sequestration, which is the hammer right now, is put into effect. That's the first thing.
Mr. Chair, it sounds very similar to the discussions that we have, you know, in our caucus and discussions that you've been leading with fiscal policy and the operating budget of creating baseline information now so we can be better prepared planning for the future so we can use that. And when we hit that deficit approach, using a sniper effect instead of a shotgun effect.
There are some states that don't even appropriate federal monies. It's not even in the budget. Not even seen there. It's taken for granted. The legislature has no control over it whatsoever. I mean, I would not recommend that. I would not recommend going down that road. It's just like it's too significant amount, and there is so much, so many programs and so many activities in which the states are partnered with the federal government, or you're partnered with your local colleagues to execute various programs, deliver various services. So there is some self-reliance on one another. On the other hand, it's when you're in Washington, you know, you're a long way from Washington, D.C. when you're here. And I've lived in three western states in my lifetime. And, you know, I felt the same thing about how far away Washington, D.C. is. And, you know, the composition, it's very, very easy at the federal level to lose sight of the fact that there are recipients at the end of the rainbow here when you're into reducing programs, but yet not changing the rules, not changing the expectations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fedkoff just pointed out we received $2.4 billion from the feds. And we cry when we have to replace and backfill $4 million, $2 million, $1 million here. We can feel it. Representative Jewell, Guttenberg, Edgerman, Costello. Huh?
Is that one person?
Representative Jewell.
Yes, I had four questions. I'll ask your
problem. We have till 4 o'clock.
No, as I was listening to and I'm watching all of the different pieces that are in play. A lot of that has been in play for several years and over more than one election cycle. Your optimism for the next election cycle is striking to me. And so...
It's a personality flaw.
Yeah, well, I guess my question is, you know, the word that I often hear is gridlock in Congress and... Ultimately, as a nation, looking globally, what does that cost us?
And I don't know that you can answer that,
yeah. Or even want to. But
to go back to one of the points I made a little earlier, it has been fascinating to watch during the course of 2011, what was originally a small cadre of U.S. senators, just six, who took it upon themselves to essentially fashion, to work towards fashioning some sort of an agreement or at least an outline of where they needed to get to. And that group now numbers in the 40s. Yes, I know it takes 60 votes to do anything in the U.S. Senate, but that to me represents some progress. It also means, though, that those members who are out at the extremes have not bought in yet. The ones either they're far left or they're far right. They are not a part of that 42 or 43 now. Same thing over in the House of Representatives, where things, you know, the House of Representatives is pretty much run like a parliament. The majority party has all the votes. They always have all the votes. And the minority doesn't, and sometimes is invited to participate and sometimes not. That's just the way it works. But the fact that you had won a budget resolution, even though it didn't get any support from the minority party and it didn't get any action over on the Senate side, and then you had two members strikingly different in their political posturing, along with Senator Mike Simpson from Idaho, who's a former Speaker of the House in the legislature there, and then Congressman Heath Shuler from North Carolina, who's better known as a former quarterback for the Washington Redskins, and sort of lead a new group of 100 members. I mean, those 100 members stuck their necks out to sign off on a sheet. Granted, it's only a letter. It only says that we need to do a comprehensive plan. But to me, that is a reminder that this is possible. And the same thing with all those reports that are out there. Those reports were written and recommendations were made. And now we asked this question of both Senator Simpson and Mr. Bowles when they did their committee. Like, how did you get there? And it was like, all you got to do is look at the numbers. And all you got to do is look at the entitlement programs and how broken the tax code is. I mean, and that's why I said earlier, if you,
you're getting to my point of frustration, Representative. The point of frustration is the members all agree, and a lot of the outsiders agree, but when you get them into their party caucuses, that's rough.
Hey, Representative Guttenberg in Edgemont.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of other lines that you could put up there that are relevant to us, certainly.
Yes.
Roads per mile, roads per person, coastline, oil and gas. I mean, the number of issues that we have to manage as a state is always astounding. When I talk to legislators from other state about what we do here, we have so much more here than everybody else that we've got to manage. A lot more resources where states either have one or two, where we've got oil, gas, timber, mining, fisheries, coastline, Arctic issues. You know, we would be last on a lot of those, in some places behind Guam or the Virgin Islands. You know, I mean, we see that. I remember watching Senator Stevens debate on the floor. Oh, I think it was a number in the millions for rural lighting for airports. And he said, okay, let's get rid of the rural lighting to airports. Let's just pay for roads to all those airports. You know, and that kind of defeated the opposition to it. I mean, I don't want to really change the debate, you know, what we're doing on, but, you know, the reality of what we have here is the only the 49th state, but also the least state with a lot of things, but also clearly the most to offer in going into the century with, you know, all the work that Representative Jewell's done on Northern Waters Task Force. Where are we going into this next century? I think that this is still a place for a fantasy for a lot of people. They want to go to Alaska. We have a lot of things to offer. But I think that, you know, for example, the salaries and wages and understanding what that's about is important. But, you know, we've been blessed with a lot of things here, and we just need to take advantage of them.
Representative Benjamin and then Costello.
Actually, Representative Guttenberg was beginning to make the point that I was going to make in terms of teasing out some of the unique...
Thank you, the next... No.
And sort of teasing out some of the unique characteristics that maybe Alaska has that other states may not have, because it's difficult to compare one state to the other, obviously. But you look at a state that's, almost 70% owned by the federal government, and so you've got a bunch of land managers, you've got a lot of federal infrastructure because of that, you've got 34,000 miles of coastline, you've got Coast Guard, you've got fisheries that are world class, you've got a military basis that, you know, once upon a time we were much more strategically important in the United States, but still are military bases in a much more high-cost environment. You've got 220 tribes in terms of the tribal relationships with the federal government that probably make up a lot of that grants section there in terms of the being first in that category. So it'd be interesting to hear your take. If any of that sets Alaska aside, at least somewhat, you know, on a weighted average comparing Alaska to other states, that make us maybe a little bit more unique, or would your response possibly be that, sure, Alaska's unique, but so is Vermont, and so is California, and so is Texas, and every other state in the union?
As an employee of NCSL, all 50 states have their own uniqueness. and I'm for all of it.
Yeah.
But, on the, you know, having lived in Colorado, having worked in Arizona, Oklahoma, you get a little bit of a sense, as opposed to, you know, where I live now in Virginia, where in Virginia you have a lot of procurement act. You have got, the state is completely reliant on defense contracting, completely. I mean, it's a huge, huge component. But the issue, I think, the western states, whether they're, you know, whether it's Alaska or the others that are on this side of the Mississippi or this side of the Rockies, for that matter, you know, you got all that federal presence, all that federal land presence, and some of that's been recognized over the years, whether it's an impact aid of certain kind or payment in lieu of certain kind. Nothing big, nothing huge, I don't think. Nothing that's something that rocks the boat. I'm going to guess that your delegations, regardless of who's in your delegations, represent that. And
to their colleagues, whether in the administration or in the Congress. But it's a good point. I mean, you raise a good point in terms of both my own personal presentations, but also, I think we tend to report on these things sort of blandly, that they're all the same, that the program that might be an environment program in this state is the same program over here, but it really isn't, even though it comes under the same title or whatever. So I'm going to take your question statement as and yours and use that as, maybe a better, even a different way to present some of our information. Because, I don't think, this is cold. These are just cold, hard numbers, and there's not much more than that there. I'm not sure I'm capable of making them, more localized. What's Mr.
Chairman, it's tempting to want to get behind the numbers more because I think the premise is rock solid. These amounts coming to Alaska are going to decrease. I mean, I think that's an absolute given. But when you look at the numbers and you dig deeper to see what they're actually attached to and whether they're programmatic in nature or whether they're discretionary spending or whether they're earmarks for God's sakes, if I can say that word. it's just fascinating to compare ourselves to some of the other states, and knowing that, of course, we had a high-ranking senator for many, many years that might have brought these numbers up. If you look 10 years, 20 years in the past, maybe our ranking wasn't so high in some of these categories, but it sort of inched up, and then maybe the 90s it went really high, and this, that, and the other. So I know it's beyond the scope of our brief discussion this afternoon, but I would be interested in looking a little more at the numbers and getting a better sense of what they really mean to Alaska.
Representative Costello, then Faircloth.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bird, my question has to do with whether or not there was any guiding principles with regard to the list that was open for cuts and the list that isn't. And one that stands out to me, and I know we're dealing with it in Alaska because there's a bill in this building with a $10 million fiscal note for making up the loss of federal funds for childhood immunizations. And so here's a subject matter where if all the states are paying and filling in those loss of federal funds, but one doesn't, then what difference does it make? I mean, it is such an important, somebody's got to do it. And so I'm wondering if there was a decision there just to sort of test out what the states could shoulder in terms of their part, and then with the idea that later there would be a look then at some of these necessary areas where there's no sense in letting childhood diseases have a resurgence.
Great question. The only one I can answer. This is going to be helpful. The decision to cut the pie the way they did and to exempt certain programs or not exempt others is traceable back to the early 90s and the late 80s when they did something that was called Graham Rudman Hollings. It was their way of reining in spending prior to the economy taking off in the early 90s. So what they did is they went back to old law, essentially said, let's go with what we exempted or didn't exempt back then. That's it. That doesn't mean that they didn't negotiate. There isn't one or two over here that fell off a list and one or two that were added to the other list or whatnot, or a program that didn't exist at the time, but that was their source. It was the easiest thing to do in a very, very short period of time with a credit rating downgrade breathing down their necks. But yeah, that's the source.
We'll have one more question, and we'll finish the presentation and ask them after, just in case. Looks like we're losing members here. So, Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's more of a statement. As NCSL provides additional states opportunities to reflect on what's pending before us and knowing that anything political can change,
we all have a tendency to try to support why our state shouldn't be cut by that particular level and describe how unique we are, as our delegation will do on our behalf when the fight begins. But with the information that you've provided us, Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering whether it would behoove us to take 10% of our federal spending and set it aside in preparation for a loss of funding so that we're already seeing it this year. In budgets that are coming forward, the specific budgets that I have in front of me are already showing signs of specific pullback of the federal government. And we are going to have a surplus again this year. And we have bills out there that are talking about savings. But if we have a, in my estimation, we have a number. We can either believe the number or not. We can be more conservative or less conservative. But should we respond so that we have longer, a longer lead time in planning and helping our communities, both at a state level, at a local level, and then at a village and a remote location level, so that they have more time to respond? We're sitting in a unique situation with the money that we have in the bank, some of it that we can use without a three-quarter vote, others that we'll need to work together on at a different level. So I just wonder whether, when we look at savings, if we should have a conversation about a specific line item for loss of federal funding and start preparing ourselves. You've been leading the charge in talking about price and production to every department that we've had in front of us. This is on top of price and production, another variable that we think is going to hit us. And, you know, from a fiscal policy perspective, how do we balance that risk, or what do we do to mitigate that risk for Alaska as a whole? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And it will be continue to be a concern of ours with what we have and what people want. And we, every day we get new legislation wanting more money. And I had each week I get groups coming in there and I says, you know, I have no problem with your projects. Pull your hand in a little bit, you know, ask for less. Because I think, you know, what we're trying to do by holding the growth of the budget is, instead of 2 years being a deficit, maybe make it 3 and 4. Maybe we can build somewhat of reserve, and I'll let you get to that one. It's the side. But
if I can point you all, at the very end of the copy of the presentation, there are 5 pages worth of identification of what programs are covered, which programs are exempt. It's not every program. That's a federal program. But I think it'll give you an idea, because it'll give you a sense of going forward. On a lot of these issues. And the other part on Representative Faircloth's point, I think it would be good for us and certainly sit down with your staff, because, you know, the federal folk programs work under such different rules. You obviously don't have control over a disability payment to an individual, which is showing up in your federal funds. And there are some grants, if you don't spend them when you're supposed to, then the money goes back into the pot. So I think it would require some serious research into what you could or cannot put aside, and safely either not cede the money or block it from being used, because you don't have any real control over its use. Am I making sense? I mean,
Mr. Rube, what I was suggesting is saving our own general fund dollars so that if the federal government withdrew support, that we would have 2 years to respond instead of most states that may not be in that position to be able to give us a little bit of time to do that.
I highly recommend having your staff talk to the folks in Vermont. They probably did the best job of how to do this and how to plan. It's a small state, smaller budget. That doesn't have as much federal fund presence, but they've done that. They put it aside. They put it in statute. And so now it is governing. The money is set aside. And that's how they offset some of the 2.7% reduction that they experienced this year in federal money.
Just to let you know what we've done here, we had error monies years ago. The stimulus fund money, and this committee told everybody who received any of that money not to hire one person with it. And we're coming back with people. We created this program. It does this great thing. We said, we told you not to hire anybody, not to create any programs, fund other things. And now they're coming back. But this works. We said, I don't care. find the money elsewhere. We're not going to replace it with the general fund money. It's a stiff line, but when they were told, I believe, 4 years ago, not to, and, you know, the man to my right was very stern on that. I mean, that was federal funds. Don't get into what we're replacing with federal general funds. So we thought that was a good chore, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that I heard something correctly, which is if we can expect, if it was across the board cut, we would expect a 9% reduction, and we could just apply that number to what we've got in front of us in terms of what we know about what the federal government is. But I thought I heard that the next year the sky was the limit, that it's not necessarily 9% or 9% of the part that we can already get our hands on. Is that not correct?
You're talking about thing two now, or pot two. Yeah, I mean, after fiscal year 13, it's all one pot. The discretionary pot is all one. Yeah, now you're talking about finding somewhere in today, somewhere $90 to $95 billion in reductions from either defense discretionary or from domestic discretionary, which is your state federal programs. It could all come from one of them. It could all come from just one program. And the other thing that's really odd that you need to be aware of on these reductions, if they take place, is that the sequester is applied to the whole program or the whole account. So if a program has got six accounts in it, everything goes down. Everything goes down by that percentage, not just the overall spending number. And you know, all of a sudden you've got some room to maneuver. But all the accounts and sub-accounts within it go down the same percentage. We'll see how long it lasts. Huh?
This is a question, I don't know if we have any formula programs that we get federal funds from. And I'm looking at education or something that could drive, you know, and all of a sudden that money goes away and we have to backfill. And we're saying, hey, we don't want to backfill it in formula funds, you know. It's just a question. I mean, there's going to be that time. Somebody's going to have to make that decision. My friend to the right's leaving us. This is going to be the people maybe left in this room. So
you, too bad for me.
Well, the fights are the best, aren't they?
Yeah. And if you know how much was 9% of what we get? Is it 48 million or 50 million? We get 50 million of that though. That's nothing. They cut that 50 million years ago, right? Years ago, man, they had a goal to cut 50 million for 3 years in a row, and I don't think they ever got it. But
yeah, but that was the state budget.
Yeah, this is the state one. Yeah. So, any other questions? We all have things. I want to thank you for coming up here because, you know, we heard you and saying in Florida. I think everybody should hear it. And that's why we brought you up here. Hopefully people will save the video and say, whoa, you know, like we did, other than after 2 days of hiding down there. Because, you know, people were, you know, this was kind of strange. They're talking about saving $5 million a year as a goal, putting into their permanent fund to start a permanent fund. $5-10 million, and they're sitting there thinking, whoa, you know, again, I wanted to wear one of those Mardi Gras masks, you know, today.
Mr. Chairman, I hope you, with all the power and authority that you'll have, you'll be able to get the entire committee to the next meeting, correct?
Well, how many were there? Was, let me tell you a story. You guys kept calling, NCSL's calling. I don't want to go to Florida. I don't like to travel. And so I told Casey, ask him why you want me to go there. And their answer was actually pretty good. And one of two, obviously one of 75 people who write a state operating budget in the U.S. out of, 350 million people. And I said, that really came home. And I said, well, you know, and you're right. So we go to that meeting and we have several staffers there. And we have, probably four or five staff there. And we have, 30 states present, maybe that? The rest of them couldn't afford to go. I mean, and that's when I went home, and I said, good grief, you know. And this was just on the House side that we had, you know, that many people to do that. And I wouldn't have gone otherwise, and you know, they kept calling it in case he got upset and said, come on. And when I heard it that way, and I says, you know, I can't. So I flew all night to get down there.
So we know how to get him, get you.
Get me to go somewhere? Yeah. Yeah. Motivation. Wow, yeah. I don't seek gold membership at Alaska Airlines. You know, I just want to go home when fishing's over. Live a humble life. Comments? Adjourn? I'd say, let's just wait. We have tomorrow, we have Wednesday, H. Bill 56, H. Bill 216, H.B. 253, H.B. 264, 302, and bills previously heard, 130 tomorrow. And, Mike, I want to thank you again for coming up here and entertaining us and getting live with something, but at least not as depressed as we were going to be. We knew, some of us knew that this day was coming and it still is. So,
if I can just say, I mean, this state pays very good money into the National Conference of State Legislatures. You should call upon us whenever you have. I think there have been several of us who have been here. This year. I think I'm the first one from the Washington, D.C. office. But, I mean, you pay for these services, and you should be able to call upon us whenever you can. So I'm prepared to come back.
When you have good news? When you have good news?
This was the good news.
We haven't lost anything yet. Man, you're suppressed out here. Okay, with that, we're adjourned until tomorrow. Thank you.